Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Brian Lynn.
And I'm Katie Weaver. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak slowly, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English. Coming up, Andrew Smith presents Ask a Teacher. We also have Words and Their Stories from Anna Mateo. And we close the show with an American story. But first,
United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres says that rising ocean temperatures present urgent risks for people living in the Pacific Islands. Guterres made the comment while at the Pacific Islands Forum taking place in Tonga. The country is a collection of about 170 islands in the southwestern Pacific Ocean. The UN chief said studies suggest the southwestern Pacific faces more extreme sea level rise than other parts of the world. The problem, he added, is linked to sea temperatures in the area that in some cases are three times higher than worldwide levels. Warmer temperatures cause water to expand, and this can cause sea level rise. I am in Tonga to issue a global SOS, Save Our Seas, on rising sea levels, Guterres said. The UN leader said that rising seas were amplifying the number and severity of storms and coastal flooding across the area. He said such flooding can destroy fisheries, damage crops, and poison water. All this puts Pacific Island nations in grave danger, he said. A report recently released by the UN's World Meteorological Organization showed ocean temperatures in the southwestern Pacific are increasing at up to three times the worldwide rate. Guterres said the Pacific Islands are especially at risk because much of their land is just 1 to 2 meters above sea level. And, he added, half the infrastructure is within 500 meters of the sea. Many scientists blame the planet's rising temperatures on pollution from fossil fuel use. Guterres said the Pacific Islands can expect additional sea level rise of 15 centimeters by 2050 if the pollution levels do not drop. Guterres urged world leaders to greatly increase the level of climate-related investments, especially for at-risk countries, to help fight the problem. Delegates to the 2023 UN Climate Change Conference approved the establishment of a loss and damage fund to help poor nations deal with climate disasters. Developed countries must deliver on their finance commitments, Guterres said. He added that one commitment calls for doubling financing to at least $40 billion a year by 2025. I'm Brian Lynn.
Many travelers face a common problem, jet lag. It is the feeling of tiredness people get when traveling a long distance, resulting in a difference in daylight hours. Nobody wants to miss the fun because they are too tired to enjoy their vacation. Here are some tips on how to deal with jet lag. What is jet lag? Scientists define jet lag as the effect on the human body of traveling across time zones. Sophia Axelrod studies circadian rhythms at Rockefeller University in New York. She said a circadian rhythm is like a biological clock programmed into almost every cell in the body. The clock is set by the 24-hour light and dark pattern, Axelrod said. Every morning when we wake up, specialized light receptor cells in our retina receive a daylight signal, which is transmitted to the brain and, from there, to the whole body. When we travel to another time zone, our eyes do not receive the daylight signal at the usual time. This causes our internal clocks to reset. But that process can take a while. During that period, we feel the effects of jet lag. Is jet lag preventable? People who travel long distances often want to prevent jet lag. One way has a high cost. Malcolm von Schantz is a professor who specializes in circadian rhythms at Northumbria University in Newcastle, England. He said that paying a lot for a bigger seat and more space in an airplane can prevent sleep deprivation. He knows most people cannot pay so much to travel, but he said timing your flights can help. For example, he suggests flying from Europe to North America during the day so that it is evening when passengers land and they can get to sleep. If you take the evening flight instead, you'll be woken up at midnight to be served breakfast and land an hour or two later, when both jet lag and sleep deprivation will hit you hard, he said. Von Schantz also said flying in newer model passenger jets, like the Airbus A350 or Boeing 787 Dreamliner, might help. He said those planes can maintain a more comfortable atmosphere inside, causing less tiredness. What should you do when you arrive? Experts say being in sunlight is important to resetting your internal body clock. That could mean either avoiding morning sun or seeking it out, depending on where you started. Getting light in the morning will move your body clock forward, while light exposure in the early evening will delay it. Sleeping for a short time during the day is acceptable, but scientists warn against sleeping for longer periods later in the day. Doing so might make it harder to sleep through the night. Are there supplements or medicines for jet lag? The brain naturally produces a chemical hormone called melatonin when the body thinks it is night. Taking melatonin as a supplement can be helpful, but it is not available everywhere, and in some countries like Britain and France, you need a doctor's permission. Von Schantz said that one of the good effects of melatonin is that you can start taking it before you travel to begin the process of resetting your internal clock. If you're in a part of the world where melatonin is available over the counter, you can combine the effects of light and melatonin to achieve the advance or delay in your body clock that you need, he said. What can you do to deal with the effects of jet lag? Russell Foster of Oxford University wrote a book on circadian rhythms. He said business travelers might want to consider arriving a day or two ahead of any important meetings or events. Being jet lagged can lead to unwise decisions and unpleasant emotions. Tourists might not need to think as clearly as business travelers, but they should still be careful, he said. He advises tourists to get enough sleep before doing anything that might be risky or that requires a lot of attention, like driving. Foster said he tries to increase his exposure to light when he arrives at a new place to prevent jet lag. But he also has another method if light does not help. He drinks coffee. I'm Jill Robbins.
This week on Ask a Teacher, we consider expressions or idioms and offer some advice for learning them. An idiom is an expression formed from two or more words. But an idiom's meaning often cannot be understood just by knowing each of the words in it. Let's look at the following sentence as an example.
We want our students to think outside the box.
Here, the words outside the box form an idiom. If you only heard this one sentence, you might not be sure what it means. But people use idioms in connection to situations. For that reason, they usually say more than one sentence, and this can help you understand the idiom. For example,
we want our students to think outside the box. That's why we push them to find creative ways to solve problems.
By looking at these two sentences together, it can be easier to understand the meaning of outside the box. It means to think in new or creative ways. In addition to considering the situation to help you understand the meaning of idioms, here is some other advice. Digital translation tools continue to improve, but you should avoid translating the idioms directly, word for word, into your native language. When you hear a short group of words that seem very unrelated to a subject under discussion, those words will often be an idiom. Be sure to learn the tone or feeling an idiom carries with it. The best way to learn about the tone of idioms is to ask native speakers about them. Native speakers might also be able to tell you if an idiom is commonly or rarely used. When learning English, it will likely be easier for you to understand idioms than to use them in speaking. However, if you can use idioms correctly, that can help deepen your connection to native speakers. With thousands of idioms in English, there is a lot to learn. But do not throw in the towel. In other words, do not give up. Instead, knock yourself out, or try hard, and do your best to learn them. And you will feel proud as a peacock. You can learn all about idioms by following our Words and Their Stories program, or you can download In the Loop, a guide to American English idioms. For our readers and listeners, do you have a question about American English? Send us an email at learningenglish@voanews.com. And that's Ask a Teacher. I'm Andrew Smith.
And now, Words and Their Stories from VOA Learning English. Today, we talk to you about expressions dealing with payback, getting even, and revenge. When a person wants to even the score, that person might have the proverb, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, in mind. The Merriam-Webster Online Dictionary describes it as a repayment in kind, as revenge for an injustice. in kind means in the same way. The expression, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, is ancient. It appears in the Bible and in the Code of Hammurabi, a set of laws written by the ancient Babylonian king of that name. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth describes a way of thinking. It is the idea that retaliating in kind is the best way to deal with a crime or some other offense. It is the idea that a person who causes someone to suffer should suffer in the same amount and in the same way. For example, if someone did something to hurt you, you would want to hurt them equally. To remind others of the proverb, people often simply say, an eye for an eye. For some people, every second counts when they are looking to settle a score. For others, the revenge method might require patience. Some people wait years or a lifetime to get their revenge. The way people settle the score can be very different. Some cultures have this expression, revenge is a dish best served cold. The idea is that settling the score over time without emotion is the best way. A similar expression is tit for tat. Tit for tat is often used to describe diplomatic disagreements between nations. It is hundreds of years old. Both tit and tat mean the same thing, a strike or a blow. Experts say the expression changed from tip for tap to its present form after years of sound changes in the English language. Tit for tat literally means blow for blow. Merriam-Webster says it is an equal return given for some wrong that's been done. Now, let's hear two friends use some revenge expressions.
Did you hear what happened to Tom? Someone slashed his tires. It cost him hundreds of dollars to replace the ruined tires.
That sounds awful. Does he know who did it?
He suspects it was his ex-girlfriend, Diana.
Why?
Well, he scratched up the paint on her car last week. I'm still friends with Diana, and she told me a security camera caught him doing it. It cost her hundreds of dollars to repaint her car.
Well, it sounds like they're even now. You know, an eye for an eye and all that.
And that's Words and Their Stories. Until next time, I'm Ana Mateo.
The Murders in the Rue Morgue by Edgar Allan Poe. Part 3.
My housemate in Paris, Auguste Dupin, was an interesting young man with a busy, forceful mind. This mind could, it seemed, look right through a man's body into his deepest soul. After reading in the newspaper about the terrible murder of a woman and her daughter, Dupin was consumed with the mystery. He questioned the ability of the Paris police to solve the crime. I told Dupin that it seemed to me that it was not possible to explain the strange details surrounding the killings.
No, no. I think you are wrong. A mystery it is, yes. But there must be an answer. There must. Let us go to the house where it happened and see what we can see. I know the head of the police, and he will permit our visit. It will be interesting and give us some pleasure.
I thought it strange that Dupin
thought the activity would give us pleasure. But I said nothing. It was late in the afternoon when we reached the house on the Rue Morgue. It was easily found, for there were still many persons, in fact a crowd, standing there looking at it. Before going in, we walked all around it, and Dupin carefully looked at the neighboring houses as well. I could not understand the reason for such great care. Finally, we entered the house. We went up the stairs to the room where the daughter's body was found. Both bodies were in the room now. The police had left the room as they had found it in every other way. I saw nothing beyond what the newspaper had told us. Dupin looked with great care at everything, at the bodies, the walls, the fireplace, the windows. Then we went home. Dupin said nothing. I could see the cold look in his eyes, which told me that his mind was working busily, quickly. Dupin said nothing about our exploration until the next morning, when he suddenly asked me a question.
Did you not notice something especially strange about what we saw at the house on the Rue Morgue?
Nothing more than what we both read in the newspaper, which was unusual indeed. How shall we explain the horrible force, the unusual strength used in these murders? And whose were the voices that were heard? No one was found except the dead women. Yet there was no way for anyone to escape. And the wild condition of the room, the body which was found head down in the chimney, the terrible, broken appearance of the body of the old lady, with its head cut off. These are all so far from what might be expected that the police are standing still. They don't know where to begin.
These things are unusual indeed, but they are not deep mysteries. We should not ask what has happened, but what has happened that has never happened before. In fact, the very things that the police think cannot possibly be explained are the things which will lead me to the answer. Indeed, I believe they have already led me to the answer.
I was so surprised that I could not say a word. Dupin looked quickly at the door.
I am now waiting for a person who will know something about these murders, these wild killings. I do not think he did them himself, but I think he will know the killer. I hope I am right about this. If I am, then I expect to find the whole answer today. I expect the man here, in this room, at any moment. It is true that he may not come, but he probably will.
But who is this person? How did you find him?
I'll tell you. While we wait for this man we do not know, for I have never met him, while we wait, I will tell you how my thoughts went.
Dupin began to talk, but it did not seem that he was trying to explain to me what he had thought. It seemed that he was talking to himself. He looked not at me, but at the wall.
It has been fully proved that the voices heard by the neighbors were not the voices of the women who were killed. Someone else was in the room. It is therefore certain that the old woman did not first kill her daughter and then kill herself. She would not have been strong enough to put her daughter's body where it was found. And the manner of the old lady's death shows that she could not have caused it herself. A person can kill himself with a knife, yes, but he surely cannot cut his own head almost off, then drop the knife on the floor and jump out the window. It was murder then, done by some third person or persons. And the voices heard were the voices of these persons. Let us now think carefully about the things people said about those voices. Did you notice anything especially strange in what was told about them?
Well, yes. Everybody agreed that the low voice was the voice of a Frenchman. But they could not agree about the high voice.
Ah, that was what they said, yes. But that was not what was so strange about what they said. You say you have noticed nothing that makes their stories very different from what might have been expected. Yet there was something. All these persons, as you say, agreed about the low voice, but not about the high, hard voice. The strange thing here is that when an Italian, an Englishman, a Spaniard, and a Frenchman tried to tell what the voice was like, each one said it sounded like the voice of a foreigner. How strangely unusual that voice really must have been. Here are four men from four big countries, and not one of them could understand what the voice said. Each one gave it a different name. Now, I know that there are other countries in the world. You will say that perhaps it was the voice of someone from one of those other lands. Russia, perhaps. But remember, not one of these people heard anything that sounded like a separate word.
Here, Dupin turned and looked at me.
This is what we have learned from the newspaper. I don't know what I have led you to think, but I believe that in this much of the story, there are enough facts to lead us in the one and only direction to the right answer. What this answer is, I will not say. Not yet. But I want you to keep in mind that this much was enough to tell me what I must look for when we were in that house on the Rue Morgue. And I found it. What did I first look for? The path of escape, of course. I mean, we agree the killers were not ghosts. They could not move through walls. So, how did they escape? At first, I saw no way out. It had been necessary for the neighbors to break down the door in order to enter the room. There was no other door. The opening above the fireplace is too narrow for even a child to go through. That leaves only the windows. We must make that exit somehow possible. Remember, there are two windows in the room. Both of them, you will remember, are made of two parts. To open the window, one must lift up the bottom half. One of these windows is easily seen. The lower part of the other is out of sight behind the big bed. I looked carefully at the first of these windows. It was firmly closed, fastened like the door on the inside. To keep the window closed, to fasten it, someone had put a strong iron nail into the wood at the side of the window in such a way that the window could not be raised. At least it seemed that the nail held the window closed. The nail was easy to see. There it was. And the people who discovered the killings used their greatest strength and could not raise the window. I, too, tried to raise the window and could not. I went to the second window and looked behind the bed at the lower half of the window. There was a nail here, too, which held the window closed. Without moving the bed, I tried to open this window also, and again I could not do so. But I did not stop looking for an answer there.
That's all the time we have for today's show, but join us again tomorrow for another VOA Learning English program. Thanks for listening. I'm Katie Weaver.
And I'm Brian Lynn.